the Roman Empire, or Caesar, and his exploits in Gaul. So let's begin with a word of prayer. Father, how grateful we are once again for the wonderful opportunity that we do have to understand history because of your word. Not only, Heavenly Father, does your word enrich our lives in revealing your essence, redemptive salvation, a plan, capacity, enthusiasm, but Heavenly Father, it does not leave us in the dark in regard to history, past history, current history, and future history. These things reveal to us what manner of God you are, that you have not kept us in darkness, but you have caused us to be able to see and to understand the cycles of history so that we might understand what's going on in our own souls and lives. To this end, then, we dedicate these next few moments to the understanding of history. In Christ's name, amen. Caesar is one of those cases in history where God uses even the unbeliever to bring about his plan and to bring about the fullness of time in our study in which his son will come into the earth. Now, we are in the middle of the first century B.C. We are approximately a little less than 50 years away from the birth of Jesus Christ, or right at 50 years away from the birth of Christ. We are studying the battle for Gaul, the wars for Gaul, campaign for Gaul. And as I told you last week, let's just flow into our study. The interesting thing is not only what it did in regard to the power of Caesar when he returns to Rome after the Gallic Wars, but many things happened in this time frame. Get an overall view. Forget the line on this particular map, but it's an excellent map just for getting a total picture of the Mediterranean theater. And here, of course, is Rome. And you start with the center of gravity. There's Rome. And what we're going to be doing during the Gallic Wars is move Rome. Now, forget this right here. Here's the Rhine River. The Rhine River flowing all the way and then down through Germany. And here's Germany. And we're going to be studying Gaul, basically all of modern France. And then you have Belgium, and I'll come to another map for some things. But here is just basically Gaul. Here is Britain. So what's going to happen during the Gallic Wars, we're going to move as far as Western civilization is concerned, for the first time with any significance, move into the continent of Europe, France, or Gaul, which is a big modern France. And he will cross, he being Caesar, will cross into Germany. That'll be the first time a Roman army has crossed the Rhine River. He will also cross over into Britain. That brings Britain into history. So the significance here is not only the glamour and the romance of studying Caesar, but all of the areas of Western civilization that are now being brought into focus. And I've already relayed to you the hordes of lords and warriors that have just kept pushing down. And everything is pushing down to land civilization, more and more people, causing more and more migration in regard to this direction. The Germans have already, the Germanic people have already come down in the around 300 into Rome, sacked the city. We studied that. So more and more over time, raids are occurring, and that's going to cause Caesar, at the end of his consulship, wants to be governor of the area of Gaul. He needs an area, if you recall, that is going to offer him war, power, money, all of these things. You remember that Pompey has increased the price of glory, and by already having three triumphs before Caesar, he's already brought in double the wealth of Rome, the Roman treasury, with his exploits into Greece and Asia Minor. So Caesar needs an area that will give him all of that benefit. So this brings us now into the study of Gaul. And one just a little closer look now as to where Gaul is. This is modern France. so that you can see here's Belgium, and then here is Luxembourg, up here are the Netherlands, and Switzerland right in here, and then Italy here, Germany over here, and then all of this is modern France. And so here are the Pyrenees, separating it from Spain. So here is where we're going to be studying Gaul in our study. So having that orientation to where we are in all of this, let's now continue where we left off last Sunday evening. Now, according to my notes, we are in Roman numeral 3 in our study, and we have to do this by letters at this point. And A, we started off, I gave you just the territory of Gaul so that you would be familiar with it. And then you want to be familiar with Gaul in regard to the time of Caesar. And by the way, these maps are from different map books, and some of them are taken from various editions of the Caesar's commentaries in regard to the war. But you can see this is Gaul in Caesar's time. And you want to take a look. Here are your main areas of Gaul. There's the Rhine River. And you have Belgium, Belgic Gaul. And then you have the Celtic Gaul, which is down here. Then you're going to have the Aquiline Gaul, which is south of the Rhone River. So this is the main area. You'll recall that Caesar divided up the area of Gaul. We were in the midst of looking at point 7, and point 7 had three subpoints, so let's begin right at that point tonight. We are at point 7, the brief history of Gaul, and I think now I've well documented for you where it is, and you should be beginning to become familiar with this area. Let's note very quickly, we noted subpoint 1. Now, this is just a very brief history to give you a feel of this area, of the barbaric people, tribal people, never really centralized into any kind of an economy or an empire, not even really any great city-states. The French really would like to recolor this brief history or this early history, but truth is truth. And they're just a barbaric type of tribes of people who have migrated into this vast area north of civilization. And so now let's take a look. During the 4th and 3rd century B.C., it's a period of migration from eastern France and Germany. Migration waves of warriors spread out in all directions across the face of Europe. Tens of thousands of migrants spread through the Alpine into the fertile Po Valley. And the Po Valley, if you can see the Cisalpine, means the South Alpine area, here the Alps, here is the Po Valley. So, and right down, go down here is Rome. So here's Italy, the north of Italy. And so they've come in into this area is where I'm pointing to. Tens of thousands of migrants spread through the Alpine into the fertile Po Valley. Then southward to Rome. We studied in 390 how they sacked the city of Rome. And they migrated into modern Hungary, Romania. 279, warriors attacked the sacred oracle of Delphi in Macedonia, and then were driven out of Greece. And they moved over into Asia, even as far as Turkey. All right, now that brings us to subpoint 2. Under subpoint 2, the 2nd to 1st century, these barbaric people, the German migrant people, barbaric people, the Celts, retreated. And as the Roman Empire and as well as the Macedonian Empire gained power and influence, these people were forced to settle in the Danube River or valley and beyond the Alps. Now here are the Alps. You got a large mountain range coming through here, so they have to settle outside of the north of the Alps area to stay away from civilization. occasionally these northern tribes would break through and terrorize both the Gauls and the Romans. This will be, by the way, Caesar's excuse for invading Gaul. The Germans had twice terrorized Rome. The latest period, around 100, at the time of Caesar's birth, in the days of Marius, who was able to push the Romans back, but near defeat for Rome. And Caesar's going to not let them forget that. It's kind of like keeping Pearl Harbor alive as far as readiness and preparedness is concerned. This is what Caesar's going to do 50 years later. He's going to remind them of how the Germans came down. It just gives you a feel of what he's doing, because if I can relate things to your history, somebody comes up and mentions Pearl Harbor, there's something in our mind, oh yeah, we were not prepared. And they came in and devastated us, and we've been to the monuments in the Arizona over in Hawaii. So there's something about it. Well, this is the same thing that Caesar did. He just said, remember when the barbaric Germans came down and how they almost devastated Marius's great army. So we need to be prepared. And almost any Roman, like any American, yes, we want to be prepared. We can't let that happen to us once again. So this is what Caesar will do. Caesar made continual reference to this disaster, and therefore he proclaimed that Gaul must become Rome, or it would become Germanic. And if it became Germanic, then that was going to be the marking the end of Rome. Subpoint 3 is the 1st century the B.C., which is the century that we're in the midst of studying. The territory of Gaul, again France, the territory of Gaul, the Celtic people, lay in the territory from southern Germany through France over to Britain. It was a land of flux migration, and by that just a great deal of moving around, no real unity, similarity in trade, but no form of centralization. And while there is a thread of common economic and cultural ideas, but even that, that it is there, but it's there by the very nature of being nomads and migrants, and so it's something that would be common just by the very definition of being human. So the way they would prepare food, the way they would trade, would be a common element through all of this area, from the channel all the way through over to Romania. And because you're dealing with a migrant type of people, some more warlike, some less warlike. But nevertheless, there would be that common element. But no centralization. This was not a nation by any stretch of the imagination. Caesar painstakingly describes various tribes and differences in coming up with the three divisions of Gaul that I've already laid out for you. Here they are: Celtic Gaul, Belgic Gaul, and then you have Aquitian Gaul down here in the southern part. And therefore, it is much more accurate to think of France at this time as a multitude of people spreading throughout the area, spreading outwards, and from coming across from Germany and just spreading all over into the entire area at this time. Just a great amount of migrants. By 125 B.C., beyond where we are right now in our study, by 125 B.C., Rome had established the region, and it was pretty much Romanized at this time. This is not beyond our times, before. By 125, we're moving down to it, I apologize. We're moving down to where we are in 125. Now, Caesar's going to go in 58. But at 125, Rome had established the region of North Italy up to the Alps, and then over to the Pyrenees. So if you kind of drew a line coming down south of the Alps, come along the water route here, come across over to the Pyrenees, Rome had pretty much established this area and had somewhat controlled this area. The territory became most lucrative as far as trade was concerned. Rome had to gain and maintain control of the Rhone Valley. It was vital to direct routes to Gaul and to other areas. So you move across up through here. Very important trade routes all along in this area. And Rome had to protect all of those trade routes. All of these areas along the way were greatly influenced by Roman civilization, financially, culturally, law, in so many ways. And in 58 B.C., Caesar will move beyond this line. So if you just get in your mind, without a whole lot of memorization, just looked at a map, south of the Alps and along over to the Pyrenees, this was the trade route. And now Caesar is going to adventure beyond the line that Rome had established. Now that brings us to B. Brings us to B under Roman numeral 3. B, Caesar's commentary on the campaign of Gaul. I want to make a few comments about Caesar's commentary, because it's one of the first times in history, probably the first time in history, say probably, because there's always somebody will come up with something. You learn that in history. But the best we can tell, it's the first time in history that this type of writing had occurred. Now, Alexander, his later writings will be made of his exploits. But this is the first time that a general actually wrote his own commentary year by year and had them published. So I want to take a look at it. Here's a copy, translation, of course, one copy. I think it's probably the best as far as its illustration and its editors and the things that they've done with it. But it's simply called Julius Caesar, The Battle for Gaul, and it's his commentaries on the battle. Now, let me go through why he did this. I want you to appreciate the man. I'll bring up the commentaries occasionally so you'll know what we're talking about. The commander himself wrote of his campaign. He did it year by year and had them actually published year by year, and then he had them dispersed in Rome. And again, this has never been done in history before, but there's a very important reason why Caesar did this. Point one, a prolonged campaign like Gaul would mean that Caesar would be absent from Rome and the Roman politics for a long time. However you want to take notes is fine. I'm just going to kind of go through this. I've got it by points so that we can make transitions. But a prolonged campaign, as you will understand, this is going to take some 8 years, 7 or 8 years. That means that he's going to be out of Rome for a long period of time. He's going to be out of Roman politics for a long time, which of course means that others like Pompey would take full advantage of his absence and undermine him politically, which would of course mean that he would have nothing as far as a future in Rome would be concerned. So it's that old thing, out of sight, out of mind, see? And so here it is with Caesar, and if he's gone from Rome, Rome will quickly forget him, and people will take advantage. Pompey would take advantage, and his enemies will take advantage. Point two. So the first thing that Caesar did was to establish his military headquarters in northern Italy. Now, kind of get this in your mind, because he will return to northern Italy occasionally. So here, if you look up on my map, here are the Alps. Here's Gaul coming up in this area. And move down toward here is Italy. This is northern Italy. Well, he would have his headquarters up here in northern Italy. And the reason for that, to which he would return, by the way, he would return there every winter. So as we kind of go through this, every winter during the campaign, the Gallic campaign, Caesar will return here during the winter, and which brought him at least back into Italy. and therefore close enough to keep some information lines open with what's going on in Rome. Now, point three. But even with that, Caesar needed to have his name kept alive in the city of Rome. He needed to have his name kept alive, for he had enemies who would stop at nothing to rid his influence in Rome. He had competitors like Pompey, Crassus, who would love to have power over him. So you can see all the problems going on with a man like Caesar. And so he needed to have his name kept alive in the city. So he had to do it in such a way, by the way, not only there, but it had to be done in such a way that his name would be prominent and his praises sung and talked about. So this is his problem. He's going to be gone for a long time, but he must do something in order to that people are talking favorably and his name is constantly there. So point four. Caesar was a genius. You have to realize that. And he was a genius, one of those geniuses in all fields. Some people are geniuses in science, some in medicine, some in music, and they can't even put on the same colored socks, this type of thing. But Caesar is a genius in all areas. He has a common influence of genius. He was a genius not only in war, and among his areas of genius, he was a well-educated man. A man of rhetoric, in fact we studied a little of that, a genius of letters, meaning he could read and write. And Caesar did an ingenious act. He wrote of his wars year by year and then had them published in Rome year by year. See? So he would think about it. He would have his wars. He would write on them. And then at the end of the year, he would have them published and distributed in Rome. This is what we should have been doing with a lot of our class. We're never going to be able to go back too many years over what we should have been doing it year by year and with a lot of our studies. But this is what Caesar did. Now, this kept his name alive. Kept his name alive. By so doing, Caesar placed his name there. You got to realize all the things that these things did. One, they kept his name alive. They kept his praise alive. They kept the activity of the people. People started becoming familiar. It's much like with us. What happens? Now, we have CNN and we had all of this. But what did we do? Many Americans who couldn't have told you where Iran, Iraq, Jordan, Kuwait, Persian Gulf, any of that was. All of a sudden, everybody knew. Virtually everyone was interested. And we were talking about it. And we wanted to read the paper, wanted to see the well, this was his television. This was what was going on with Caesar. And he did it with such flamboyancy and have it all there. That people were talking. And if you had any, and remember, these are warlike people, like many Americans. So this generated a lot of conversation. And it was quite ingenious. No one had ever done this before. But let me give you a principle about it. Let me give you a principle. By doing this, Caesar placed his entire future, he placed his entire future on the line. Now, this meant that he was going to have to win. See, if he was going to write year by year and publish them year by year, therefore, if Caesar failed and was defeated, it would be better for him to die on the battlefield, for he would never be able to return to Rome. So, by doing this, he really put himself in that kind of a bind. Now, a lot of generals were right after the campaign. Now that I've won, let me tell you how great I am. See? Let me tell you about my exploits, like Alexander and the other people who wrote of themselves, some of the pharaohs of Egypt. But what Caesar did, Caesar just was taking you through the entire campaign, year by year, and kept everyone talking, kept his name at the front, and virtually demanded that he had to be victorious or just not return home. Point five. But if he did return to Rome, he needed to return victorious, and he needed to keep his name and his praise alive. And he would do this by writing of his campaigns. He wrote his commentary book by book. Each book was complete in itself. Each book, it's fascinating to read this. Each book is just a, I learned a lot in reading this. Each book was just a total campaign, a total book in and of itself. And then you put the whole thing together. It's like the Bible. Bible is a campaign and a book, each book in and of itself. And then you put the whole thing together and you have the Bible. And so this is what he has done. He has just taken each year, that was a book, and then put the whole thing together for his commentaries. Now, point six, I know many of you will not have time to read this, but the style of writing is very important. This is true of almost any writer. This is why some people make it in the writing field and some do not, and you know it if you read books. So there are some people who can write in, with mystery or some intrigue, the flow, whatever it is that they're writing, fiction or nonfiction. And there's just various ways that make certain people writers. And other people try and think it's easy and realize they just, you know, it just doesn't work. Their book doesn't sell to anybody except their mother. And, you know, it just, it's very difficult. And Caesar had his own style. And you learn a great deal about a person by noting their style of writing. And Wiseman and Cunliffe point out in this particular edition of Caesar's campaign, they write out and they state in regard to his style, Caesar's writings were uncluttered and factual. As you read through it, it's not long, drawn out. He wouldn't have made a good pastor teacher. And not long, drawn out. It was uncluttered and factual. And Caesar, by his own commentaries, has denied man the future to change or write their own accounts. And that's another very important thing about these commentaries. A lot of people can write about Alexander and Napoleon, but Caesar said nobody else going to be able to write. These are the facts. They're right to the point, and here it is. And so he really, nobody else can come along and even later in history and rewrite it. Now, I want to read to you what Cicero, Cicero actually, but what Cicero had to say in regard to the commentary. Cicero's view of Caesar's commentary, contemporary of Caesar. The commentaries are splendid. Bare, straight, and handsome, stripped of rhetorical ornament, like an athlete of his clothes. He intended to provide material for others to use in the writing of history. But though he may have gratified some fools who will want to use their own curling irons on it, he has frightened off all men of sense from putting pen to paper, for there is nothing in a history more attractive than clean and lucid brevity. And that's the writings of the commentary. And you learn a lot about writing, and if you're interested in reading and writing and those kind of things, the commentary is excellent for that purpose. All right, that brings us to C. I hope you have an understanding now of the commentaries and where they come about, how they come about. All right, what I want to do under point C for you is my style and the way I like to do things, get an overall picture, and then we can come back and plug in. So let's get an overall picture of the Gallic campaigns, and then we can come back in and have fun for a few minutes and just plug in a little bit, have study a few of the wars. We won't study all of them by any means, but just study a few. Give you a feel of the, of what was going on with Caesar, with his army at this time, and with the Germans. So all I've done under C here the way I've done this is just put the years, 58, and then I'll tell you a few things, 57, 56, 55, and we'll kind of flow through the Gallic campaign and this decade of the first century B.C. All right? In 58 B.C., Gaius Julius Caesar began his Gallic campaign. Now, 58 B.C. should be in the middle of the column, and then we'll start. The 58 campaign started, the 58 campaign started in the central Gaul, north of the Alps, west of the Rhine. So if you look up in the map here, you can take a look. So here we're going to move. We're moving out. Here are the Alps. North of the Alps, west of the Rhine. So right in here is going to be the area of our battle. And remember, all of this is Gaul, but here's where we're going to begin. And let's see what we could really do. Get an overall picture. This is actually the picture of 58. But what we're going to be looking at is he will move. Well, this really isn't going to be good either. But we're going to move up across, Italy comes in, we're going to move up across into here and have the first area in the central area. So in this area will be the first battle. Now, I'm going to give you 3 points under 58. One, at the beginning of the 58, at the beginning of 58 B.C., Rome's northwest frontier ran from the Alps to the Pyrenees. Caesar felt he had to move in, that is, into Gaul, to prevent the Gallic and German tribes from invading Rome. And that was his campaign. So he's going to have to move. Once again, if you look up, here's Cisalpine. Here are the Alps. So he felt they control all this, but he felt we've got to move across now and get up here and move in and start controlling Gaul in this area. Point two. In 58 B.C., he moved beyond the frontier to drive back the Helvetic. H-E-L-V-E-T-I-C. I will not bore you or burden you with a great number of names here, but for those of you, and we have to call it something, so we'll call them what they are, the Helvetic people who were migrating west from Switzerland and from Germany. So they're moving across from Switzerland and from modern Switzerland and Germany, moving across. So if you look up, here they come across. And they're moving into this direction. So he's going to be. In fact, let's see if you can tell it on your map. This dark spot, that's what that word is right there. The Helvetic people. All right, point three. You have another group of people called the Arioius. Arioius. These were German soldiers of fortune who had moved in from beyond the Rhine. So they're going to move across and start causing trouble. So here are they. Here's this battle. If you look up on a map. So we have these two primary battles that Caesar's going to have to take care of right at front. He takes care of both of those. 57 B.C. This is going to move us to the northwest region. This will move us to the northwest region. Now I'm going to take off the 58 map and just stay with a Gallic map. Let me see what I did with my Gaul at the time of Caesar. Let's go back to this one. So what Caesar has moved in, taking care of these people. Here now, he's going to move his army up in this direction, the northwest direction. This will move him into Belgic Gaul. So he's going to move up in here, his Belgium Gaul. So he's going to move his massive army in this direction. Let me give you two things. One, Caesar moved against the distant and warlike Belgic Gauls in the northwest region. Two, his lieutenant will subdue modern Normandy and Brittany, B-R-I-T-T-A-N-Y, Brittany. Now, if you'll look up on your map, see if I can show you where they're go, where he's going to be, where they're going to move. If you look over here, in this area is where his aide, his general is going to move over into this area and subdue. This is called Brittany, this area right here. Now, for the record, that general's name is Lieutenant Publius, P-U-B-L-I-U-S, Licinius, L-I-C-I-N-I-U-S, Crassus, C-R-A-S-S-U-S. And Publius Crassus, who will be, this is not the Crassus of history, this Crassus will be killed in his battles early, much to Caesar's regret, much similar to Stonewall Jackson to Robert E. Lee. And but he will subdue Normandy and Brittany. And the two areas that he will subdue, you will come against them again, Nervii, N-E-R-V-I-I, and Ventini, V-E-N-E-T-I. And here are the Ventinis right here. All right, that brings us to 56 B.C. 56 B.C., Caesar himself will move into far western Gaul, into the area of Brittany and Normandy. So now in 50, we are in 56, so we'll put 56. He starts moving in this direction, Caesar himself. Remember that each winter he's going to make his way back down to the Po Valley, leaving his army to winter in various campsites. So 56, he will move over to Brittany and modern Normandy. All right, let's know two things. One, the Ventini, V-E-N-E-T-I, now southern Brittany, they revolted. They revolted. They're along the coastline. And they're going to revolt and cause him some trouble. Point two, the winter of 56 and 55, there's going to be a number of changes in Gaul. And the people are going to move around a lot during that winter. 55 B.C., first move into Germany. First time a Roman army will bridge the Rhine and go into Germany. It will also be the first move into Britain. The first time the Romans went into Britain. So, across the channel. So, this time he's going to, if you look up here, he's going to bridge the Rhine River, go into Germany, and he's also going to cross the channel, right up here is London, he's going to move across the channel for the first time into England or Britain. So this will occur in this year. Let me get in 55 B.C. Let me give you three quick things. One, German migrants are defeated. Two, Caesar bridged the Rhine just below Koblenz. You know Koblenz from World War II, to raid Germany. And three, he crossed the channel to raid Britain. 54 B.C., he will raid Britain again and end revolts, put an end to revolts in northeast Gaul. 53 B.C., we have the Belgic Gauls revolt. And he will put that down, and he will also raid Germany for the second time. It will bridge the Rhine River again and raid Germany. Not an invasion. That's why I'm using the word raid. It's not an invasion. It just raids it in Britain. It just goes across and kind of feels it out and then comes on back. So it's more like a raid than like an invasion. But it's the first time that a Roman army crossed the Rhine River or went over into the island of England or Britain. 52 B.C., Central Gaul. Central Gaul. Put all these things, just pull it out to help you get a feel of these wars. One, three things I want to say here. One, Caesar first. This is Caesar's first real challenge and first defeat. 52 B.C., Caesar will experience his first real challenge and his first defeat from a strong opposing leader. Vercingetorix. Vercingetorix. V-E-R-C-I-N-G-E-T-O-R-I-X. I think if he wanted to be remembered in history, he should have shortened his name. All right? Vercingetorix. And he is quite a leader, and he will be the first really opposition, the real opposition that Caesar will meet, and also give Caesar his first defeat. But he'll pay for that. Point two, the Battle of Gergovia, G-E-R-G-O-V-I-A, very important battle. And then three, the Battle of Alesia, A-L-E-S-I-A. He will win all of those eventually. And that brings us to 51 B.C., Central and West Coast areas. Central and West Coast area of Gaul is now conquered. 50 B.C., remember he's going to die in 44. In 50 B.C., really it's a year of mop-up and organization. He organizes his newly conquered territory and prepares to return to Rome. All right, major point D. We're now moved to D. See, I gave you a brief idea of the campaigns and the outline of the overall. Now let's go back under D and take a look at some of the more romantic and enchanting things of the campaign. All right, point D. We'll start out with 58 B.C., the Helvetic people, H-E-L-V-E-T-I-C, the Ariovistus, A-R-I-O-V-I-S-T-U-S, Central Gaul, north of the Alps, west of the Rhine. All right, let's take a look now and to what we're going to be looking at. I'll pull the 58 map. 58 B.C. map, so that we can follow what Caesar's going to do and just some fun. I will not belabor this, but a few things on it is worth our noting. All right, first of all, the Helvetic people. And if you'll look here, here are the Helvetic people. So let's take a look and note just a few points. One, the Helvetic Gauls were forced southward into Switzerland by the Germans. In other words, they're going to come down from Germany. They're forced southward. If you're looking up here, they're forced southward into Switzerland and then cross Switzerland into this area, into Gaul. So they're forced into Gaul by the barbaric Germans. So they are migrant people and being forced into this area. Point two, the Helvetic people are in danger of being cut off from Gaul by the Germans. They asked Caesar for permission to migrate. They asked Caesar for permission to migrate west peacefully through Roman provinces of Gaul into southern Gaul or France. So they asked for permission to do this peacefully.
Point three, Caesar refused. One, he did not know where they were going or where it would end. Why? Where would it all lead if he did let them go, and where would they end up? And to be sure that to be sure that they did not pass, and this gets you into some of his engineering, he built a 19-mile earthwork. A 19-mile earthwork. That just means a big hill of dirt. When Jim Passmore and I did traveling through some of the campaign areas of the war between the states, called by us Southerners the Second War for Independence in American history. But we were just amazed at the amount of really just digging. It seemed like they were always digging. Every battlefield had all the earthworks. I mean, you go and you just tell, boy, they must have gotten tired of carrying that shovel around. And that's all they were doing was digging. And, you know, you dig this great big mound and then die there. And, it's quite a feat. And, so what Caesar did, he built a 19 miles of earthwork, an earthwork wall with command posts, along the way between Lake, Geneva and the Jura Mountains. So he's, going to build, see if I can, find some of these areas for you. Where we are in the air building of the wall. Here, right here is the area where he starts the wall, right in this area. See, here they are. So he builds this wall, 19 miles, which would be through the pass area with the various forts to block this. And this demonstrates the Roman military engineering, the building of the forts, all of this type of thing. Point four, Caesar garrisoned 5 legions from northern Italy in this area. He garrisoned together 5 legions from northern Italy. 5. The Helvetic people were frustrated by Caesar's line of fortification, and so they moved northward through the Jura, J-U-R-A, through the Jura Mountains. 6. And these points are just reading through the commentary. It helps you to follow through again. 6, Caesar attacked the rear guard of this movement of these people. 7, Caesar then pursued the main body over the next 2 weeks. 8, the Helvetic people found out that Caesar was having logistical problems all of a sudden, especially in the area of food. Therefore, they made an unwise decision to attack the Roman forces. Caesar took command of the situation, and like Joshua, Caesar ran the battle late into the night, although Caesar did not ask God to hold the sun in place so he could fight on into the night. You remember that story in Joshua where Joshua asked God to leave the sun in place because he was being successful in the battle, but it was getting dark, and that would put an end to the battle. So Joshua said, ask God to leave the light on for a little while so that he could make final pursuit and destruction of the enemy. And God did it. And, Caesar ran the battle on into the night, though he could not have asked God to have the light taken on. And he decisively defeated the enemy. Therefore, point 9, Caesar then resettled the Helvetic people in their Switzerland homeland. He resettled them, moved them all back into Switzerland. Now, just for to know the man Caesar, it would have been simpler to sell them as slaves, and it would also have given him some money. But Caesar needed them as a buffer from German infiltration through this area. So it was better to keep them as a friendly people, a buffer people, between himself and the Germans as he moved on to do other things. So rather than sell them as slaves and treat them in that manner, he moved them back and got them organized so that they would be that buffer people. Next came the Ariovistus, Ariovistus. We're still in 58 B.C. Point one, Caesar... Caesar's next war was with Ariovistus, king of a Germanic tribe. That's his name. A-R-I-O, Ariel Vistus, V-I-S-T-U-S. He was a king of a Germanic tribe. Two, Caesar's Roman forces had never fought the Germans. Now, this was the first time that the Romans ever met the Germans in battle. Now, there were a few who fought some of the German slaves in the Spartacus Rebellion, but that wasn't a German army, and they were just rebellious slaves fighting with other slaves of descent. But this was the first time that a Roman army actually is going to engage in a head-on land battle with a Germanic army. So the Germans were tall, the Germans were strong, and had developed a warlike reputation. And in many things, when you read Caesar's account, people, and this is 58 B.C., describes the Germanic people right up to this day. If you read 58, all the way through, and you start just, if you just say, okay, I'm going to write characteristics of these Germanic people in 58 B.C., you'll find characteristics of this, of the area of the Germanic people that are so true today. And their hardness and their perseverance and their the way that they are. So Caesar will describe these people. It's another great thing about this. It's a great book for historians in regard to these people and the tribes, the way they lived, fought, different things we get from Caesar. I'm just showing you as we go through this, why is he so great? Well, he touches so many areas of history. And here we're using him now as archaeology and history and sociology, military. So many things we're going to learn about this whole area we learn from these commentaries. So he writes us. So these are the German people. They had a reputation of warlike. Therefore, there was a fear. There was actually a fear among the Roman forces. But Caesar's leadership, personal fearlessness, inspired, first of all, his elite 10th Legion. You want to remember that. His 10th Legion was his elite legion. And when that legion was inspired by Caesar, it spread through all the officers and then among the men. Often I will be talking to you about his phenomenal leadership and how he will just inspire the people to his troops to garrison themselves and pull together and function as an army. It is said Caesar's ability of motivation that he could move a mob to riot and inspire an army to battle. That just is the way it is given through several history books that I read. One way or another, that was what they were saying. He had the rhetoric, the ability to move a mob to riot and inspire an army to battle. Didn't say what he did with women, but it says that he had could handle a riot and he could handle an army. All right. Point three. Caesar met Ariovistus in a major battle. Now, I'm just going to give you some of the battle facts. We're not going to study it, but just so you can appreciate what's going on. Caesar, his army had 21,000 legionnaires plus 4,000 Gallic horsemen, giving him approximately 25,000 soldiers. Ariovistus led an entire German community in mass of 120,000. The army defending this mass included 6,000 cavalry, 22,000 infantry, with a force of around 28,000. All right, here's what happened in the war. One, the enemy, Ariovistus, pitches his camp 2 miles from Caesar with the idea of cutting Caesar's supply lines. Point two, Ariovistus, we'll call him the enemy so you can take notes, desire to avoid a direct encounter. Therefore, refuse to meet Caesar's army in battle. There are a few cavalry skirmishes, but the enemy refused to meet Caesar. This is just one of the things he had to contend with. Point three, at the same time, Caesar marched part of his army past the Germans to a second camp, restoring his supply line. Four, two legions were left in the new camp, four legions in the original. So we have two legions, just to give you a feel of what we have occurring here, so that you'll see they would not battle. So here is his headquarters. Here Caesar's where his first camp is, and his supply line is back in this direction where he had just came out of. So what happened was the Germans built their camp here. So what Caesar did, Caesar moved his army, moved these legions, and formed a second camp, a second area with two legions in the new camp and four legions in the old headquarters. All right, point five. On the next day, the Germans attacked the new Roman camp. The battle lasted from noon till sunset. Sunset. Six. The next morning, Caesar led a triple line attack from the old camp. So the enemy has moved here. Now, here's what happens. Caesar, marching now, has a triple line attack, and he's moving his army toward the enemy. Seven, the battle turned into a long, bloody hand-to-hand battle. Eight, the German line was broken on their left wing. So if here is the German line now, standing here, their left wing was broken. The German line was broken on their left wing. Nine, the Germans put a great deal of their strength on the Roman left. So if you're looking at the map, here's where their strength is. Here's the bulk of the German strength on the Roman left side. So therefore, Crassus, remember him, Publius Crassus, Caesar's ablest officer, who will die early, pulled the third line over to reinforce the hard press. So if you look up at the map, what Crassus did, he took command of this third line, moved them to reinforce here. So now he's got a whole army area here, not just a line, but a backup line, reinforced line in this area, and to take care of the left side. And 10, the result was a complete slaughter of the Germans. The result was a complete slaughter of the Germans. Ariovistus and his mass moved across the Rhine River, never again to cross it. Never again did this German tribe come across the Rhine River. Therefore, in the first year of the Gallic campaign, Caesar has won two wars, two battles, defeated two forces, one a German and one a migrant force, and by so doing, stabilized the eastern front of Gaul. And that's what Rome was going to hear about. That's what Rome will read during this winter now, the winter of 58 to 57. They will read, going into 57, how Caesar has now control along the Rhine River and has restored order in this area and has a Roman block to prevent the German people or any migrants from moving in force into the Gallic area. And he will tell them all about the exploits of the war that I've just given to you briefly. And they will be talking about it just as we do with every little thing that went on in Desert Storm. So you have something you can relate to. And they will sing praises of Caesar just as we did with Schwarzkopf and various people. And that's what they will do in Rome with their hero Caesar. People love a hero. We're no different than ever before in history. And the hero at this time is Caesar. It's glamorous. It's glorious. It's victorious. It's Roman. And it's going to protect their property. It protects them from the north. And gives a lot of occasion for discussion and talk and argument. And keeps his name in this year in front of the people. Well, we'll let the Romans talk about it for a week, and then we'll come back to the 57 and finish up the Gallic campaign, and then we will move to Caesar's death. All right, let's close now in a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, how grateful we are for this opportunity to study history, to understand these things, not only in the area of individual combat, but to understand that we are in a spiritual combat, that we must always garrison and be prepared on all sides and all fronts, not, Heavenly Father, for self-praise, but for the praise and of the glory of our beloved Savior. In His precious name we humbly pray. Amen.